Accession number 9751, reel 9.
Mr. Frank Ray in reel 9. You said that the battalion was in and out of the line as usual. What were you doing within this? Because I understand that you were able to avoid some of the worst consequences.
Well, I was. I was sort of favoured. In a way, I mean, if the sergeant would say, if there was only so many, I was never picked for them, you see. Now, I remember at one farm, we used to line us up at night to be a working party, you see. Well, some sergeants would take the first 100 from the right. Now, the next night, some other sergeant would be there, we'd take the same number from the left. And sometimes they would start so far to carry, for fear anybody had missed both, like me, they would take them from the middle. But these sergeants used to generally give me the nod and say, I'll be on tonight, get yourself to the left, you see, or get yourself to the right.
Why would they favour you? What was it about you?
Just because I was one of the old originals. And we'd all been friends together and pals. And these others by now were all come up on drafts.
Was that most of them now?
Yes.
Were new?
9/10 of them, isn't there? Well, probably with just a sprinkling of the old ones, thereby getting on now.
How would you go about avoiding various unpleasant tasks? Would you positively try and avoid things by now?
Oh, yes, avoid everything you could.
How did you go about it?
Well, either go for a walk and get out of the road, and the sergeant would cover up for you on the roll, you see. And it called the names out, you wouldn't call your name out. And as soon as the party had gone, you came out into the open and just mingled again.
So this was while you were in rest camp, you were most able to avoid working parties?
Oh, yes, yes. Avoided many a dozen.
What about when you were in the line? Would you avoid going to the line in the first place?
Couldn't, no.
But when you were there, would you be able to avoid the worst?
Yes, I didn't do a great deal on account of my duties as looking after the food and whatnot, you see. I wasn't put on the wiring parties and things at night that the others did, and patrols and covering parties.
Did the others resent that? They must have noticed.
Others? I never heard about it. There was one man once called me a bloody scrounger, but he was he had to do everything to the book and was most... Well, he was a chap that did everything he was told and wouldn't bypass anything. Well, I said, you're a bloody fool, Bob, that's all. You've been there 3 nights. And I said, I'm not doing any of those if I can avoid it. And I said, if you have a mind to go there and do that every night instead of getting yourself at the other end, that you will look on.
Did you ever feel guilty about...
Not at all.
What could you explain what you felt about it?
Well, when I came on leave and saw the people at home and the way they lived, I had no doubt about who was getting the worst of the war. And whatever I did, I was doing a hell of a sight more than 90% of the people.
When did you get your first leave?
Well, it was 23 months after I got to France, after we got sailed. I was sailed in the December 15. It would be
November
17.
What other impressions did that leave make upon you?
Oh, I don't know.
What did you do?
What do when?
When you went on leave.
Well, really, I hadn't a girl, I hadn't a pal, and mother used to cotton on to me, went to the theatre and the pictures and that sort of thing, and part most of the time I was bored stiff. I went round to see if there were any friends that I did know. There was one crippled lad in a chair. He was very popular. I spent a few days and whatnot at his house. But the biggest luxury that I could ever think, and I have never forgotten it, was bed. Was a decent, a clean bed. And under the circumstances I didn't mention previously, but one of my greatest grievances in the army, I'm going back now to when we left the Somme to go to Neuve Chapelle, they took the one blanket that we'd had, that withdrew the one blanket and left us without a blanket at night, and I always resented that.
Did that continue, the lack of blanket? Did you ever get another one?
Not until, I suppose, till the weather got cold. But fortunately, there again, I had a friend on the transport. The one I told you that
kept the Luger, yes.
Carried the Luger and the binoculars. He carried a blanket for me as well. So I wasn't that badly off.
How long did you got to the Somme in January 1917? How long did you stay in that sector?
The second time?
Yes.
Heavier turn. I don't know, but we seemed to be there indefinitely.
Did you go anywhere else during 1917? Were you involved in either Arras offensives or...
No, nothing. I saw nothing like that.
Did you ever go up to Vimy Ridge?
Vimy Ridge? Oh, of course we were at Vimy Ridge.
That was in 1917, was it?
Hey, no. Would it be before? I wouldn't know, but it was after the Canadians, not very long after the Canadians had taken it.
Round about April or May.
Oh, I do not know, but I always remember Vimy Ridge and St. Mary's and a light railway track, and then there was came to the ridge, and there were our dugouts, which were about 6 feet deep, and they captured the German ones on the other ridge, and they were about 40 feet deep, all banked up with tiers of beds and everything beautiful. Yes, they were about 40 feet, and that was the way the German army ran to it. I mean, no matter how our people talked about the artillery, which I had no respect for, ours, they could never get down to them at all. That's what happened on the Somme. Apart from our explosives being lousy, I mean, if they'd been as good as theirs, they wouldn't have made any difference. Because they were that deep, where we, 6 feet down, our way was a lot. But they were down steps, one leading down there, and then perhaps a place from here to those houses over the road.
About 40 yards.
Yes, and then, well, no, it wouldn't be 40 yards. 25 yards. And then up another flight of stairs, see? The two exit and entrance. Yes. Now, while I was at Vimy Ridge, I can't tell you what period it was. But there were these magnificent dugouts that the Germans had. And we didn't see any fighting there. And I don't think we fired a shot. I remember seeing Arras absolutely levelled, and going to see the cathedral there, which was also levelled, and there's been a terrible lot of shell fire because it was absolutely pitted, the ground, and we used to use these shell holes for lavatories, and the Germans also left quite a number of hand grenades, which we called Tätimaschers, because they were entirely different from ours, and they weren't as good as ours or anything like. Now, our hand grenades were good, the little Mills bombs. You could throw them further than those things. Theirs, had, theirs were like Tätimaschers. And I saw one day that I'd just been using one of these dugouts, these shell holes, and one of our lads was down the dugout, and he'd come up with some of these German hand grenades, and he was throwing them, walking along, throwing them into the shell holes, till I said to him, "You silly devil," I said, "there might be, anybody might be down there," I said, "I've just been in one of them myself." So of course he stopped doing it, but it could have been killed like that. You don't know really when you were out there how near you were to death many times. Or how, for instance, when I came out of the army, I was sitting one day in the office, and that finger was prickly, and playing on with it like that, I eventually broke the skin, and I went across to the first aid place, and there was, he got a pair of tweezers, and he pulled some bits of a bullet out of my finger. The, really, the bullets, some of them were just plain sort of copper, and others had a sort of coating over them, and this was a bullet had evidently just cheered that finger and left this outer covering of the bullet in my finger, and the prickle, of course when I got it out it was all right, but I hadn't felt it up to that. That was the first I knew of it.
Were there many accidental deaths? I mean, that would have been an accident, the guy throwing the hand grenades.
No.
Were people responsible, usually, with the explosives they had round them?
Well, some of them were idiots. You had to watch them. For instance, the first job I ever did when I went into the trench, the front line, was inspect the bombs to see that they were all right. There were generally two or three boxes of bombs with half a dozen or so in. I used to take these out and see that the pin would throw easily, you see. I always thought that might be the difference between life and death if you got those out, and of course they were evil little things, those Mills bombs of ours.
Did you ever throw them?
Yes.
In action, I mean?
No, never threw one.
You had a lot of confidence in them, though?
Really, they were the best things I think we had for trench warfare. If that night, now I don't know whether any of our other fellows at Neuve Chapelle when we were attacked, if they threw them, I didn't know, because of that many bangs and that going off, there was that much row. You got a bit confused, you know, and a bit excited, but as I've said before previously, fighting's all right when you're on an equality. But if you can't fight a machine gun half a mile away.
Were there any... The war had been going on a long time now. The battalion had been reconstructed. It wasn't the battalion it was.
Oh, no.
What was morale like? 1917.
A lot of these new ones that came up. Now, I'll give you an instance. Now, I remember him distinctly. We called him White, known as Whitey. And he was from the Broad Town side. And he came up to us. We were a lot of... We'd seen nothing, you see. And, what he'd done in some particular wood, Delville Wood. Oh, what they'd done in Delville Wood, chasing these Germans round the stumps of trees and all this sort of thing. So we stood this a little bit, and that one or two of the old ones got together like me, and we'll teach this joker a lesson. So I got the sergeant, and he came round with his notebook, and he said, "Now then, Whitey," he said, "we're going on a bombing raid. We've got to get a prisoner." And he said, "I'm picking half a dozen good men." And he said, "I know you're an experienced man at this sort of thing," so he said, "I'm putting you down for a raid tonight." Well, he nearly fainted. He nearly fainted. He was frightened to death. He went and sat down, and he never uttered another word. And wasn't till an hour or two later the sergeant came round. He said, "Oh, you can pull yourself together, Whitey." He said, "The raid's off." But it quietened him. He never said another word about his fighting abilities. And that's what the more anybody that talked like that, they were all big mouths and were no good.
Did you get on well with the new men?
No.
Was there actual friction? Or was
we were no friction, but we were never sort of mixed. The old ones, no matter what rank they were, we were all stuck together. In fact, I have photographs upstairs there, taken with the sergeants and different groups, but they're all the old ones. If I told you who they were, they were all relics of the originals.
Do you think this sort of divide, do you think it damaged the total battalion morale?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. But they were a different race apart. They might have been niggers as far as we were concerned.
Were they not from Durham?
Well, they were mixed. I know we got a lot from Yorkshire once. A very poor sample.
What was poor about them? What was wrong with them?
What was wrong with them, physically and mentally? I had six men once on an advance post at Givenchy, and there wasn't one sound one in the six.
What's sound and what isn't sound?
Well, one was nearly deaf. How the heck that I got him, I don't know. Another one was about 5 feet two or so, and he was terribly knock-kneed. Because I remember having to pull him through the mud. He couldn't drag his feet out. And there was something wrong with every one of that six. There wasn't... If the Germans had come across, they could have just picked them up like flies.
Were they willing to fight?
No. No, they were poor. I thought we'd rake in the bottom now of the barrel when that lot came.
No. From part of what you said, most of the original 10% by now weren't really willing to fight that much. Would that be fair?
Of our own lot, they were the originals. Well, they had these other lot to look after. We had to show some ability in that direction.
But I mean, a lot of them seem to have been avoiding things like working parties and things like that. So.
Well, it just became a scrounging parade. But most of the old ones by this were sergeants and had gone off wounded and killed and that sort of thing.
So, in your opinion, the 18th Battalion wasn't that good a fighting unit by 1917?
Oh, a load of rubbish. The whole British Army was, anyhow. All the good.
Did you feel that at the time?
Yes. All the good ones had been killed. If you were a good man, you got killed. You had to scrounge to survive.
Do you think, would you have classed yourself as a good man by then?
I would not, no. I wasn't a good soldier then.
Can you explain that? I'm not getting at you. I just want you to explain what you felt.
What I felt was that I'd had enough. That it's time somebody else did something.
Had you been worn down by the danger, or by the discomfort, or by the routine?
Discomfort and filth, and it went on so long. By which time, you see, we're getting into years. And there's never anything to look forward to. Except drudgery and filth.
Was this more important than the danger? Was it worse to you than the danger, or was it a combination? How did you feel?
Well, I was never a hero. And I used to get frightened. Especially of his great plumbing damn things, and his trench mortars even were frightening. And bullets whistling past you was frightening. But the filth and the lice and the rats, nobody realised what they really were like. They were very... Your morale got sucked. But they did, the authorities, they did the best for us. They got us... They started with baths. And that's where my story starts, really.
I'll come back to that, because that's after the March offensive. That's how you got away in the end. Now, as morale declined, did you have any cases of military indiscipline?
No. Never saw one, never had anything like that. Never saw a man refuse to do anything.
So people would still obey orders if they had to. Would that be right?
They always had to obey orders. I never saw one that didn't.
But I mean, if they couldn't avoid it by a legal means, so to speak, then they would obey, they'd do what they were told.
Oh, yes.
They couldn't find an excuse.
No. Even a Lance Corporal had authority.
What about, were there any cases of self-inflicted wounds or deliberately inflicted wounds?
No, no, I never found one, never. Never heard of one.
Were there any cases whereby people would try and make wounds worse?
Yes.
When did that start? Yeah. When did that start happening?
Oh, yes, now then. You've got me to start with, but...
Leaving you aside for now, because... I know that comes into the story later.
I remember a man, and they called him Buck Walker. And he was wrapping his arm up one day. He had, I don't know whether it was a cut or a wound of some sort, and he'd found a rusty nail, and he was fastening the rusty nail into this with a bandage. And I said, "What the heck are you doing, Buck?" And he just gave me a sly grin. He was trying to make it so, of course, it would fester or something, so that he could get away. Now, I was just thinking about him the other day. I don't know what happened to him. He just disappeared. And his people were in Hartlepool, and they were quite... Well, they lived in the best part of Hartlepool at the time. I mean, he was good family. So I don't know what, but that's the only instance of that and myself.
You didn't know of any other instances of that happening?
No.
People didn't try and get deliberate light wounds then?
They couldn't very well. You couldn't discriminate. You either got it or you didn't. You were sent a working party. I remember the chappie that I'd palled up with at that time, and I mean palled up with, slept together, you see, to be warmer. A lovely fellow, a Durham County cricketer and a footballer for Hartlepool United amateur, and really...
What was his name?
Jack Bennett. Really charming chap. But Jack was destined, I always thought, to be killed. Now, I came on leave, and while I was out for a walk one night, I went past a house. And I knew this chap to be, this house, to be a big noise in Jack Bennett's works. He was a draftsman. So I went and called on him. By this time, I mean, I didn't regard anybody as a better man than myself. And I never have done to this day. So I called at this chap's house, and I put the case of Jack Bennett to him. And I said, "Mr. Williams, I would going to tell you something." I said, "I'm a great friend of Jack Bennett's." I said, "Do you remember Jack Bennett was the new drawing officer?" "Oh, yes, I remember Jack Bennett." "Well," I said, "he's going to be killed." He said, "What do you mean?" "Well," I said, "he's no soldier to start with." And I said, "But he takes it. But it's killing him, his nerves. But," I said, "he perseveres and he doesn't try to let anybody know. But if ever I saw anybody that was destined to be killed, it's Jack Bennett. And I would appreciate it." I said, "He's too fine a chap to be killed." I said, "I know all the best ones are being killed." So I said, "If you could manage to wangle him back, you would have the knowledge of knowing in afterlife that you saved his life." So he was very nice. He talked with me. He said, "Well," he said, "I'll see what I can do." I said, "That you can't do more than that." Damn it, I came back and Jack Bennett was killed within a week of me going back. But that's what he was. It was the best fellas were always killed.
Did that upset you, your special friend being killed?
Oh, very much, very much. Made me more bitter than ever.
Now, this bitterness, what exactly were you bitter against by now?
Everything. Everything associated with the war, especially the Germans. Although I will say our authorities, they did well for us, and I was always very lucky. I've no grumbling on that account. For instance, when I came on leave, the quartermaster, by the way, his son lives across the road there, had a new suit and everything laid out brand new for me to go on leave. Little things like that, you see, that counted.
A new uniform, you mean?
New uniform, new underclothing, new everything.
But you were still bitter?
Well, I was, yes. I was bitter against authority. I was bitter against the Germans. It told me quite a lot, did that.
Was there you mentioned there were no... you only knew of one person who bound this nail into his wound.
Yes.
Was it... One thing I missed out then was, although this was the only one you knew of and saw, was it a common knowledge that this sort of thing went on within the 18th?
No, I never heard of another instance.
So most people were content to wait for an act of God, so to speak, to get them a blighty wound?
That's right, that was what they prayed for.
What did they feel about blighty wounds? What did you feel about blighty wounds?
We were always hoping you'd get one. For instance, when I came with mine and showed the doctor it, he said, "You bloody fool, you might have lost your arm." I said, there's thousands out there, I said, would willingly give an arm or a leg to get out of that. I said, they're all...
And you felt that while you were in the trenches?
Oh, yes.
Would you talk about it with each other?
No.
So it was just a common feeling, but yes. you didn't actually talk about it?
No.
After you'd been on the Somme and then you went up to the Arras front, to Vimy...
Yes.
Did you go back to the Somme again then?
Yes, back to the Somme.
And how had things changed there? What was life like on the
just
Somme?
Just the same dreary business, filthy dreary business. Yes.
And this went on into 1918, then?
This one went on into 1918. Now then, I get myself a bit lost then, because it got to be fine weather, and we were rushed up when the Germans broke through in 1918. And then began the open country stuff. And that was where my intelligence and experience, I reckon, saved my life.